Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Impact Vest podcast, transformative global innovation in a new era of impact. I'm Aisha Williams, the founder of Impact Vest, and along with our guest host, we aim to inspire and motivate towards collective positive global impact to solve our world's most pressing challenges in sustainability. With each episode, we will engage in insightful conversations with global change makers, visionaries, and sustainability activists who wish to build a more sustainable and resilient future. Join us now as we create the future of impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Impact Vest Q4 CEO Roundtable. I am Tanya Love Lamorte, the Managing Director of Impact Research and Investor Insights. For this roundtable, we will be discussing the topic, Investing in the Real Economy, Scalable Solutions for Systemic Impact. And I have the incredible pleasure of being joined by three amazing CEOs today. Eddie Kubwimana, founder and CEO at PayVista, a company based in Burundi that is providing access to microfinance services for rural and peri-urban populations. Scott Duhart, founder and CEO at Heart IT Solutions, a veteran-founded tech firm delivering secure and scalable IT infrastructure for small to Fortune 500 companies. And Soji Sanaulu, founder and CEO at AirSmat, an AI-powered solution that helps farmers boost yields and restore soil health, as well as drive scalable carbon removal efforts. Welcome to our podcast today. Scott, let me start with you for our first question. What real-world problem is your company solving, and how has that shaped your business model and priorities?
All right, thanks again for having me. And like I said, just to get to your question, Heart IT Solutions solves the challenges of designing and implementing advanced future-ready network infrastructures for organizations that cannot afford downtime or outdated systems. Many clients operate in environments where technology must be secure, scalable, and optimized for evolving digital demands. This drives our business model to prioritize cutting-edge installation techniques, advanced testing tools, and continuous skill upgrades for our teams. So for example, in a nutshell, Heart IT Solutions, we replace outdated networks with high-speed, future-proof infrastructure that meets the demands of cloud and next-generation applications.
Thank you for those insights, Scott. We do definitely live in an environment where technology must be secure, scalable, and optimized for our ever-evolving digital demands. So thank you so much for that. Soji, I want to go over to you for the same question. What real-world problem is your company solving, and how has that shaped your business model and priorities?
And thanks for the warm intro. AirSmart, when we formed it a little over 5 years ago, we spotted a problem on the continent and also a problem that is global in its true nature, and that is the problem of food security and the climate problem that is upon us. And so for us at AirSmart, we set out solving these two problems. How do we help farmers in sub-Saharan Africa to maximize their crop yield in one end, and at the same time, unlocking the power of agriculture to reverse climate change? And that problem that we set out doing a little over 5 years ago has stepped out to be, with the solution that we're providing to farmers within the continent, has helped to solve this social problem that you alluded to, for example, a real world problem affecting mankind, affecting human beings, 1.4 billion of such people in Africa. And we are solving it using functional business model that we found out to be very useful. One question that may come to your mind is, how is AirSmart solving this problem? For example, we're democratizing the production of high-quality biochar from end-of-life waste, so we can regenerate the soil in the process, sequester carbon, and while sequestering carbon, we're able to issue these farmers carbon credit, thereby improving the livelihood of these farmers. And then the priority of these for farmers has led them, at the last count, we've onboarded over 1 million farmers working on a carbon project in Nigeria. We're expanding into Côte d'Ivoire, a French-speaking part of Africa, because we want the contract from United Nations, where we're working with 1,000 farmers in that geography. The same biochar production, sequestering carbon, and improving their livelihood through carbon credit, for example. I'll talk more about this as we go into the presentation. But doing all of this, we still wrapped it up with a software capability that we call digital monitoring, reporting, and verification application that we help to collect data from these farmers, the biochar production data, collect all of them, and then making a sense of that for the farmers, and in the process, being able to issue them carbon credit. So.
Thanks so much, Soji, for the amazing things that you and your team at AirSmat are doing to help with food security and to reverse climate change. Thanks so much. I want to go over to you next, Eddie, with the same question. What real-world problem is your company solving, and how has that shaped your business model and priorities?
Okay, can I start with my introduction? My name is Eddie Kubiman. I am from Burundi, and I recently graduated from Ashesi University in Ghana, and now I'm back in my country. And the company I'm running now is called PayVista, and what we are trying to solve is the limited access to financial services in Burundi. What we notice is that most people in Burundi, around 80% of the people, don't have access to financial services, and the almost 20% are the only people who have access to different tools like a banking account, tools to send or receive money, and also be able to access credit. And what we are trying to do is to make sure that those 80% of people who work in the informal economy can have different tools that can help them to build credit, access different tools to be able to transact or send money to their loved one, and also be able to build wealth or invest in a different kind of opportunity that are available in Burundi. And what we are trying to do now is that what we notice is that most people who live in rural area, in order to be able to access financial services, they have to go through mobile money agent, which is one of the inventions that has been influential in how people who are excluded from financial services are trying to access or even join the formal economy. And what we are trying to do is to make sure that we empower those mobile money agents by helping them to place them in different locations where people can be able to either cash in, cash out, and also do kind of like deposit to different bank accounts that they have, and also help them to create either mobile money wallet and also bank account. And what we are trying to do is to be able to certify how those mobile money agents can be able to access cash fraud, because they serve as an independent agency for different mobile money operator or even some bank that have different mobile money wallet. And what we are trying to do is that do fraud financing. For instance, we help those mobile money agents to be able to schedule either like cash or fraud to be able to ensure that they don't run out of cash when customer are coming, or they don't keep a lot of cash even if no customer are going to come or do withdraw or transfer. And at the same time, we are trying to make sure that those people who live in rural area can be able to access a micro loan. Most people in Burundi practice subsistence farming, which implies that most of them, they don't farm to be able to make money or do kind of investment. And what we are trying to do is to create a different tool that can help us to build credit profile for different people who come to send or receive money through our agent. At the same time, we include those agents so that they can be able to invest or secure a loan to either finance education for the children or farming project. And that's what we are trying to do in Burundi right now.
Thank you, Eddie, for sharing all the amazing things that you're doing to offer financial services in Burundi. Let's discuss how you're scaling for impact now. So what has helped you, Eddie, to scale your impact while still maintaining the quality and integrity of your offering?
Okay, for us, what we've been trying to do is to see how, like, with the, now we have a network of 600 mobile money agents. And what we have been trying to do is to find some commonality among the whole country so that we can be able to do automation. And what we have been able to do right now is to create a one mobile app and also one web app so that we can be able to scale easily. For instance, we can hire a new agent in a new location, and we have some metrics we use to measure the impact we are making in that location. And also with the scheduling algorithm to be able to know that, like, how can we make sure that the cash that we have or brought is well organized to the point that each agent in our network has access to cash. And that make it easier for us to be able to serve more customer without jeopardizing the quality of the service that we are providing.
Great automation example, Eddie, and thank you so much for sharing that. Now I'm going to go over to you, Scott, with the same question. What has helped you scale your impact while maintaining the quality and integrity of your offering?
I've scaled my impact by staying ahead of the curve with emerging cabling and fiber technologies, continue to invest in certifications for the latest industries. We also embrace innovation early. Now I can start to take on more complex and large-scale projects while making sure quality and integrity of ours never slip.
Thank you, Scott, for sharing your insights and how you're staying ahead of the curve. It's truly amazing. Soji, I want to pivot over to you now, and I want to ask you the same question. What has helped you scale your impact while maintaining the quality and integrity of your offering?
So, SMART solution is rooted in science, the science of pyrolysis. And because our capability, our software is rooted in science, at the heart of that is quality. And to your question, have we been able to maintain very high quality, especially in our voucher production and its application to the soil, is to leverage our software. One of the reasons why we built the application in the first place, AnyFarm app, that is available both in Android and in Google Play Store, in Apple Store. The reason why we built it as a DMRV is to cater for quality measurement, you know, documentation of voucher production process from the time we're sourcing the feedstock from the farmers up through the drying process to maintain optimal moisture content to the point of producing the voucher and applying it to the soil. We make sure that the software is capturing those data, A, to drive quality, and B, to make sure that as this is rooted in science, the data from it, as we take it to the laboratory from time to time, is at that optimal level. So in terms of quality, this is how we've achieved that. But to the original question of scale, scaling up to 1 million farmers in Nigeria for a carbon project and expanding into Côte d'Ivoire, for us, it has been at the edge of innovation, constantly ahead of the curve, looking at where the buck is going to and just waiting there. And I think that for us has helped us, and we're very involved with the community of farmers that we've been working with for over 5 years, collaboration with different stakeholders that has brought these farmers to us, has helped us in scaling the number of farmers, and while doing that with quality at the heart of it as well. So,
Soji, for our listening audience that may not be familiar Will you take the time and just explain what is biochar and why is it important to farmers?
Oh, fantastic. Good question. So, biochar, a carbon-rich substance that is obtained from the science of pyrolysis. And in layman terms, what is pyrolysis? It means burning waste, agricultural waste in our own instance, at very high temperature and little or no oxygen. It's a technique, it's a scientific technique. High temperature, low oxygen. When we pass agricultural waste through this process, the outcome is a carbon-rich substance called biochar. And what does it do for farmers? So, for the farmers, it helps them in the improvement of the health of the soil. Like we're human, we're breathing and living. The soil is also a living organism, if I could use that, and the biochar helps to improve the soil health. It helps in the aeration of the soil. And when mixed with compost, like we do for our farmers, we mix it with poultry waste that provides nitrogen. Biochar replaces a fertilizer, is a fertilizer in its own right, helping to condition the soil for optimal crop yield. And then, more importantly, and this is very important for climate, biochar helps in the sequestration of carbon from the atmosphere. So, simply put, it sucks CO2 from the atmosphere and store it in the soil for 1,000 years, for example, which is what helps the farmer to earn from carbon credit. And that whole process is what we call pyrolysis. And so ESMAD, we source the waste from the farmers. We call it feedstock, and subject it through all the scientific rigor of making sure the moisture content is single digit. We go through all of that process, pyrolysis. We get the biochar, mix it with compost, and we apply it to the soil. And with our DMROV mobile application, we are in the position to issue carbon credit, and then we bring in third-party verification into it. For us at ESMAD, we're partnering with Carbon Standards International at this current moment, and they come in to verify, have we gone through all the process? And after all that third-party verification is done to prevent greenwashing, we're able to put this carbon credit in the global registry for tradability, and farmers can get hand from these, for example. So.
Thank you so much, Soji, for explaining that. Incredible work indeed that you're doing. Let's stay with you for the next question. What operational challenges have you faced as you've grown, and how have you adapted?
Right. Good question. Operational challenge. Yeah, you raised a valid point there. Okay, for us at ESMAD, I can say this, the biggest operational complexity that we have to tackle, especially as we began to scale out, is sourcing our feedstock. So take note, we're solving the problem of climate, meaning that while solving that problem, we do not want to pump more CO2 into the atmosphere while we're taking it down at the same time. So to source our raw material, which is the feedstock, those agricultural waste, sourcing them very close to the place of production of biochar in its own is a true, in our own world, true definition of operational complexity, because we have to then identify the farmers. Do they have enough feedstock to produce biochar? So we're not producing biochar 400 kilometers away and transporting it to another 400 kilometers distance, in total 800 kilometers. So that transportation is operational nightmare. We're polluting the atmosphere. So And that for us is a like a no to start with. And how we tackle this is identifying farmers, working with them, assessing the farms and the waste in their farms, and making sure that is sufficient to produce biochar required to pull down sufficient CO2, and doing all of those maths so that at the end of the operational process, we're able to see out some decent income. The farmers can earn decent income. It's what we have perfected over these years that we have been working. Not too easy a task, but so far so good. We're doing some decent work in that area. So.
Great. Thank you so much, Soji. And Eddie, I want to go to you with the same question. What operational challenges have you faced as you've grown, and how have you adapted?
I think most of the problem that we have been facing at Pevista is that Burundi is still, the economy of Burundi is not that stable, which implies that in most cases, for example, if we want to integrate our system with the other payment system, most of the those financial institution or a mobile money operator, they don't give API, which implies that sometimes you cannot integrate with existing ecosystem, especially in the payment system. And what I've been able to do now is to try to rely on people. For instance, if, for example, you want to send money from one bank to another bank, you have to have the bank account in all those banks so that even like there is no interoperability between different banking institutions in Burundi and also mobile money operator in Burundi, which implies that you have to rely on the same system that other people are using, which implies that it has to slow down the process and make it harder for us to be able to do faster transaction or even serve more customers. Another thing that we are facing is like regulatory uncertainty. In Burundi, the fintech space is still young and there is no structure or law that guide every, like if you are developing a product, sometimes you end up finding that either you are violating the law or the central bank doesn't allow you to be able to deploy that kind of product. And for us, what we are trying to do is make sure that you stay up to date of the information of the ecosystem and how we can maybe be able to innovate at the same time, stay with legal framework that our country can allow. And another thing that happens is that capital constraint, which implies that Burundi is one of the countries that has limited private investment, which implies that it's hard for you to be able to raise capital. And what we are trying to do is make sure that either we use it's like either the profit we make have will invest back, and also when we are scaling, we have to make sure that every penny we are investing in product or services that can have high return on investment so that we can be able to scale or even invest in the technology that we want to develop. Another challenge that we face is like talent. Because of how the country is small and also how there is a big gap between the banked and the unbanked, when we want to serve those customers in the rural area, we have to hire people in those communities sometime, because of how it's like either cheap. But the problem is that most of those people in those areas don't have enough information or technology. And also sometimes the internet doesn't access those places, which makes it hard for us to be able also to serve the customer the way we want it to do. And I think that we face when it comes to our operation is that the more we scale, because we have to depend on agent, the harder it becomes to management, fraud, scheduling and making sure that our agents are accessing the service and also serving our customer very quickly as we want. Those are some of the challenges that we are facing.
Thank you, Eddie. It sounds like there are plenty of opportunities for the financial services that your company is providing. So thank you so much for all your efforts. Scott, let's go to you for the same question. What operational challenges have you faced as you've grown, and how have you adapted?
Yeah, no problem. One of the biggest challenges that we're facing is as we grow, is ensuring everyone can keep up for us training. That's one of the biggest things we're focusing on. I have a lot of other junior guys working with the senior guys, learning the different terminologies, learning the different equipments, getting hands-on. That way they can say, oh, now I know what a cradle point is, or now I know what a switch is, or now I know what a router or access point is. So it's constant training in our world. So we've adapted by creating structured onboarding and upskilling programs that train crews on new tools, materials, and techniques before they reach the job and the site. And as I mentioned, we're pairing the senior guys with the newer teammates so we can accelerate the transfer of skill a little bit faster. We also use cloud-based project management platforms, so every team member from field techs to project leads stay aligned in real time, reducing delays and improving collaborations.
Training and upskilling are indeed very important. So, Scott, thank you so much for elaborating on that point for all of us. I want to stay with you for the next question. How have you decided whether a new market or product or partnership is the right fit for your long-term strategy?
Yeah, no problem. We evaluate new markets, products, or partnerships based on their revenue potential, alignment with our core services, technology advancement, operational efficiency, and the ability to strengthen client relationships. So one of those things, like, there's still a company out there, some mom and pop who makes pizza, a pizza shop. Do they align with my core values? How will we partner together to help each other grow? It's one of those things you try to just take a lot of things into consideration. And as the question said, is it a good fit in long term? I mean, who wants to make $10 here and $20 next month or $100 6 months down the line? It has to be a partnership that just makes sense all the way around the board. But we avoid opportunities with uncertain return on investments, skill gaps we can't close quickly, saturated markets, brand compliance misalignment, or projects that could disrupt my current ongoing operations. So all those things come into play when we're talking about partnering with anything or making it a good fit.
Great insights. Thank you so much, Scott. I'm going to go to you now, Soji, with the same question. How do you decide whether a new market, product, or partnership is the right fit for your long-term strategy?
I think for us at Esmart, one of the key drivers is revenue. Was the potential of the partnership in question? I mean, and of course, alignment of our values. Are we focused on impact-driven solution, for example? And that for us has shaped a lot of the things we do. Stepping out to partner with the United Nations Agency, ILO, out of Côte d'Ivoire, these two play a pivotal role in shaping that decision. There's money on the table to be earned. And of course, the problem they are trying to solve, the impact they are trying to create, aligns squarely with what Esmart is working on. So it's no-brainer to step into such partnership. And they see to how to make it to blossom. So to your question, these two are main drivers. Is money on the table to start with, and of course, alignment of our values, for example.
Thank you so much, Soji, for sharing your insights. Eddie, I want to go over to you. How have you decided whether, how do you decide whether a new market, product or partnership is the right fit for your long-term strategy?
Okay, for us, I think what we do when we are looking for partnership or trying to accept new market opportunity, we look at if maybe the partner is solving real pain point. And also after that, we look at if the partner interest and also the ecosystem or market they are trying to work in can help us to strengthen our payment ecosystem, credit, and also trust. And also we look at how we can be able to leverage the ecosystem we already have, either agent we have, and also the tools and the infrastructure, and see how if those two ecosystems can be able to interact with each other without making us vulnerable, and also make sure that as other panels said, like if we are going to make like real profit or enough cash flow from the operation that we are going to conduct together with those partners. And after that, yeah, we can do partnership or launch a new product with those partners. Yeah.
Thank you, Eddie. And I'm going to stay with you to stay along the same theme of navigating complexity and change. So let's start with you with pivoting to similar theme, but a new question. What makes your team or leadership approach especially effective in navigating complexity or rapid change?
Okay, I think for me, it has been a big and difficult part for me when it comes to building a leadership team because of how the values and how we see things and also the vision of the company. Because I think it's one of the hardest parts that has faced me. Because anytime we try to put together either hire a new person and all those stuff, we look at how that person can be able to contribute to the growth and also to the vision of the company. And in most cases, like there is that skill gap or talent gap between what maybe we want from the people we want to work with and also what we can get from the market pool. As I said, like there is limited private investment in Burundi. For that, you have to work with those constraints. There is what we maybe, for example, if we want a software developer, we cannot hire someone from abroad because it's going to be very hard for us to be able to pay for that person. And at the same time, what we're trying to do is to make sure that we look at people who are highly motivated and also who have experience in what we are trying to do and try to build that gap, like close that gap by training and also by engaging each other, giving each other feedback and trying to learn together as a team.
Thanks so much, Eddie. And the same question to you, Soji. What makes your team or leadership approach especially effective in navigating complexity or rapid change?
Yeah, for me, as I try to pull together different people to come work for SMART, what I look at for all the time is the attitude of each person. Most of the time, I have for attitude. Do they have the can-do ability? Are they going to walk into a situation they never experienced before? I will be able to think through the problem and come out with a solution. So it's very common when we meet at SMART to say there is no right or wrong answer. And the answer that was wrong, that was right 2 hours ago, 2 hours after is now wrong because our reality has changed. We live in a very fast-paced world, rapidly changing. And what we couldn't afford to do at SMART is to be rigid. So I bring this into hiring people. I bring them in for attitude. And so far, I've been very lucky. So working with my colleagues, day in, day out, innovating, walking into problems that, quite frankly, we never met before. And because of what we're doing in Nigeria, I mean, the first company to ever issue carbon credit to any farmer within the country to do what we're doing at that part of, you know, being the first, we have no one to go and copy. There's no one to say, yeah, how did they do it? Copy and paste. We didn't have that. So every problem, we walked into it with that mindset. And having that team behind me, and my choice of the team to start with when I hire them is very, very important. And my own leadership structure has always been flat structure, no hierarchy. We don't go with, I'm the boss, you are next to me. We walk into each other and we solve problems. If your solution, your recommendation, your own idea is superior, yeah, you carry the day and everybody will line behind you to make sure we execute that idea the moment everybody says this is a superior idea to solving this problem. That's it. You carry the day. And I think that leadership style so far has worked. I hope it works into the future.
Thank you, Soji, so much for sharing that. Scott, I want to hear from you. What makes your team or leadership approach especially effective in navigating complexity or rapid change?
Field expertise, that's what we focus on, and that's a key driving component in my leadership style. It's what we do in the field, because 99% of my work is in the field. I mean, most of my guys are in the field. I got guys right now in the field. So we proactively commit to technology adoption. We're constantly looking at, hey, what's going on here? What's going on there? We do a lot of troubleshooting. So every troubleshooting method is not going to be the same. Well, I'm not going to say method is not going to be the same. The end result is not going to be the methods you got to get to the end are always not the same. They're going to be different. Like you, what works at one job might not work at another job. You might have to go in reverse or try something different. So troubleshooting, like I said, in the field. So with the field expertise and staying ahead of training the new tools, new trends, methodologies, even on new pilot projects, trying different things on new projects to see what works and what's going to be the end result of how we go by creating an SOP on this project. So it's in the field. That's the best place to my team know, hey, you give me a call, we're going to troubleshoot, and I'm going to give you my my spiel on, hey, let's try A through Z. One of these steps that I've done or encountered with is gonna work, but that's my approach on it.
Thank you, Scott. As you've mentioned earlier in our discussion, that training is one factor that makes you successful in your field. What about trust? What role does trust play in your growth, whether with employees, customers, or ecosystem partners?
You hit the nail right on the head. Trust is the foundation of everything we do in my line of work, with both my team and my customers. The saying, the word is our bond. That is something that we live day by day. Our technicians work independently in the field. So I trust them to show up on time, perform at the highest standard, and represent Heart IT as I would, as if I was there myself. In turn, our customers trust us to deliver quality work, exceptional service, and that trust has led to repeat business and larger and more complex projects over the time.
Thank you, Scott. Well stated. What about you, Eddie? What role does trust play in your growth, whether with employees, customers, or ecosystem partners?
I think trust is one of the key things that we use to be able to build everything that you are doing because, as I said, you have a network of around 600 people around the country. And in most cases, those people have to do self-reporting, either like financial statement or daily transaction, all those stuff, which implies that, as I said, some of the things are not automated to the point that you cannot capture every transaction and everything that one of the agent is doing. And without trust, we cannot be able to run operation. And also when it comes to people who help us to manage different region, it is the same, which implies that somehow we give them like almost every opportunity to be able to influence how we run business in that location, how we hire people in that location, depending on the cultural background and also the area, and also maybe different constraints, either internet or other things that you may not know. And also that also happens because of how we trust those people who are running those operations. And also when it comes also to micro, as I said, some people don't have any kind of a way to gauge if that person is worth a credit or something like that. And what you try to do is to focus on community trust, which implies that we look at some of the cultural element that we use to judge if someone is trustworthy and all those stuff. And we try to do kind of tests, like maybe start with a small loan. And if that person repays very well, then we increase the amount of money that we can give to that person. And what we apply in one region can be different from what we apply to another region. And that is due to how we give a chance to everybody to be able to bring a new idea and also suggest how we can be able to implement different services that you are launching in the market.
Thanks so much, Eddie. I'm sure in financial services that trust is indeed a very important factor. Soji, what about you? What role does trust play in your growth, whether with employees, customers, or ecosystem partners?
Another very fantastic and important question. Within the carbon removal space, CDR, that is powering the voluntary carbon market globally, trust is at the center of it to make sure that when we sell our carbon credit to buyers, the likes of Google, Microsoft, if we say we have done X amount of tons of CO2 pulled down from the atmosphere, then they are relying on that commitment that this is what ESMAT has committed to, this is what ESMAT said it will do. So trust is at the center, and once trust is broken, the relationship is broken. So for us at ESMAT, we recognize this. Beyond building our software to self-police our process, we equally make sure that we mean what we say, and we only say what we mean to our customers and the ecosystem partners. And for my colleagues, my everyone that is working day in, day out within their smart, that is more than important, that we trust each other as colleagues within the company. And one of the ways I think that has been demonstrated over these years is that folks come into ESMAT and they just stay, meaning the trust is fully established, ESMAT looking after them, and they are doing everything possible to make sure they look after Mr. ESMAT. All of us looking after the company and the company looking after us. I think that trust is so important. And so far, at least in our journey, we've done exceptionally well to make sure that trust is not broken.
You are correct. Trust is fundamental. No doubt about that, Soji. How are you measuring the impact your business is having, and how does that influence your decision making?
Okay, yeah, impact metrics. So, yeah, well, the first question is, what do you measure? Because one thing is how to measure, but what do we measure? So for us at ESMAT, we came up with three metrics that are so important to the work we do, one of them is signing up with our farmers, with our own direct users, farmers in this case, that we will help them increase their crop yield by 4x. So that for us, unique metrics that we measure. Number two is to help them to have more money in their pocket by opening them up to participate in the voluntary carbon market. So issuing them carbon credit. And of course, the other metric that we measure is our climate action, how much of commitment we have made, and ESMAP commitment is in the gigaton of pulling down enough CO2 between now and 2030, for example, which is not far out in that space. So these are metrics that we measure in terms of impact. So far, we've not done badly. We can still do more because farmers up and down the country in Nigeria, they're benefiting from this already. And beyond that, our role within the climate space, helping to drive carbon sequestration, is also out there for everyone to see. We hopefully in the foreseeable future, very short time from now, we'll be able to amplify this scale as we close our funding round, for example, from investors. So,
Thank you, Soji. Scott, how are you measuring the impact your business is having, and how does that influence your decision making?
yeah, we measure impact based off our network performance metrics, post installation, and client reviews. So, for example, we use our own internal metrics by reviewing our technicians' photos before and after photos. So, if they're going to do a network install, we look at the before pictures they've taken, and then we look at the after photos of the equipment they installed. Did they do cable management? Did they clean up behind themselves? Did the site, or did the network closet look better after or before they came? So we look at the photos and make a determination. Hey, is this person doing a quality job, or is this person living up to our standard? We also speak to our customers and say, hey, what was your take on the on the install? Did everything go as smooth as you liked it? Or was there any hiccups on our behalf? So between the two, we determine whether a technician is being up to par or if they're underneath the bar. And if they're underneath the bar, we got to make a change. We'll try to provide a little bit more training. And if the training don't work and they're hell bent on doing it their way, hey, we got to part ways. But we try to give everybody the tools to succeed and set everybody up for success. And like I said, even with our customers, we try to stay in contact with them and constantly making sure, assuring them that one, we're providing the best service, and two, customer service. In my line of work, even though it's a lot of technical expertise required, customer service is like just as up there as the technical component.
Thank you so much, Scott. Eddie, what about you? How are you measuring the impact your business is having, and how does that influence your decision making?
Okay, for us at PayVista, what we do is we are trying to expand our network, make sure that we cover many rural areas so that people can be able to access financial services. And one of the metrics we use to measure our impact is to see the number of new agents we onboard. And the second thing we do is to look at how, like, the transaction volume, which implies that we look per agent, how much money they make, how much money they send or receive, and also how many customers they receive per day. Another thing that we are trying to look at is we are trying to optimize the efficiency of each agent by making sure that we get a high margin per agent. And what we try to do is to make sure that each agent is trying to serve as many customers as possible. At the same time, each agent is growing his or her operation. And by doing that, we try to look at how either the loan repayment rate, how impactful each, like either if an agent bring in a project and they try to invest in that project, how that project has helped that agent to grow either financially and also how they do the, like either the marketing at this, we said earlier is like the trust, how we give each agent the ability to be able to do kind of marketing for the company and also take some of the decision. And by capturing those data, each agent has a dashboard where he sees what he's doing, how he's doing, and also receive feedback. And we try to interact with each agent on every side to make sure that we are improving those metrics that we use to measure the impact we are making throughout the country.
That's great. Thank you so much, Eddie. With all the insights that have been shared, I could continue asking several questions for several hours, but no worries, I won't. So don't worry about that. My last question, Eddie, I want to start with you. Looking ahead, what opportunities are you most excited about, and how are you preparing your company to lead in that space?
Okay, for us, what we're trying to do now, we are trying to build a credit scoring system that can be sold to either financial institution or microfinance. And what we are trying to do now is to make sure that our platform is a go for transaction, credit scoring and profiling. And also we can outsource that either system to other financial institution. And what we're trying to do now is to try to see how the government is trying to do some innovation about like the banking system in Burundi. And what we are trying to do also is to learn about how AI can be integrated in our system to be able to use the data we are accumulate every day on transaction, on loan that we give to our agent and also customer, and try to pull those things together so that we can build an alternative system where people who are in informal economy can be able to access different financial tools through our system. And that's what we're trying to aspire for the future.
Thanks so much, Eddie. Scott, the same question to you. Looking ahead, what opportunities are you most excited about? And how are you preparing your company to lead in that space?
A lot. So as of last Friday, I secured my first government project starting in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm so excited. It's about an 18-month full engagement where I'll be overseeing the project management and the cabling installation and fiber. And I have to provide all the bodies. So I'm very excited. I'm excited and sad and happy all at the same time. I'm preparing I literally just posted an ad. I have some technicians in that area, but I need to wrap up. The good news on the project, they're letting me build up to it. So baby steps. I think we start in the end of September and they're letting me bring on people here and there and say, hey, let's start with two or three people, and then we'll ramp up by the middle of October and so. So, constant hiring right now. A lot of hiring and getting people prepared mentally. Like I said, I know a lot of people in the area, so good times right now. And all goes well when that project is opening up other doors for the other government projects. So I'm very excited because the government, we're getting into the government sector, most times it's a lot of bidding and a lot of things of that nature. I'm not the prime or the sub, but I'll be able to put this on my portfolio that I was led a project from beginning to end. So very excited.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. Congratulations, Scott. How exciting. And I'm looking forward to hearing more good news as it becomes available. Soji, I want to close out with you giving the last response. So, looking ahead, what opportunities are you most excited about, and how are you preparing your company to lead in that space?
Very recently, we got the contract with the International Labour Organization out of Côte d'Ivoire. Actually, about 2 hours ago, we had the kickoff meeting for the project. That for me is a massive opportunity that everyone at TESMART, my team, and myself were very, very, very excited about. Having to expand into another country from Nigeria, and all of that being paid for by United Nations. So I look forward to more fruitful collaboration, and I hope this open additional doors to ESMAD to expand into other countries in Africa. And hopefully, when next we have opportunity to speak, fingers crossed, I'll be able to say, hey, we're now in Ghana, we're now in Cameroon. We just got to Kenya, for example. I will be so excited about that. But today, at least as a company, we're not just in Nigeria, we're operationally based now in another country, Côte d'Ivoire. Super excited. And once again, thank you for this amazing opportunity to be on this podcast.
Thanks a lot, Soji. And thank you, Eddie, Scott, and Soji, for sharing your insights and your experiences with us today regarding innovation, resilience, and scalability. It's truly been a pleasure speaking with three incredible CEOs and ImpactVest Alliance members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the ImpactVest podcast, Transformative Global Innovation in a New Era of Impact. Join us next week for another episode and become part of our ImpactVest newsletter community, where you will receive all of the latest updates about our work in this new era of innovative impact finance. See you next week as we create the future of finance at ImpactVest.